James chapter 3, for those of you who may have missed some because of leaving early for the feast, we did finish James chapter 2. And now for James chapter 3, we have an entire chapter here basically devoted to one of the keys for going on to perfection, and that has to do with controlling the tongue. And it's very interesting the way that James approaches this from several different perspectives, and we will also approach it from several different perspectives. It's one of the most important areas in the entire general epistles, James chapter 3. So in verse 1 it says, "My brethren, be not many masters." The Greek word for masters here is didaskalos, D-I-D-A-S-K-A-L-A-S, and it means teachers. My brethren, be not many teachers, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation or the greater judgment. Now, with regard to be not many teachers, there are many different ways that you can look at this. There are people who do desperately desire to be a teacher, and as it says in 1 Timothy 3:1, if anyone desire the office of a bishop, he desires a good work. So the desire to be a teacher or an overseer in and of itself is not a wrong desire. However, one should always be reminded of, as James does here, that any time that you are in the office of a teacher, you're surely going to receive the greater judgment. There is a greater responsibility upon that person. So there is nothing wrong with desiring the office of a teacher. Once again, if the motive is correct, the basic motive that Jesus Christ gave was, of course, to love. First and foremost, God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that love should be the motivating force. The method for receiving it should be Matthew 22 verses, it starts with verse 20. I'm not going to turn back there and read it, and going through verse 27. Whosoever would be great among you, let him become your servant, or one who runs through the dust for others. So the motivation should be love. The method of getting there should be service. However, there are other aspects of my brethren, be not many teachers. When it really comes down to it, any time that you open your mouth, and there are people who are standing alongside, you become a teacher to some degree. You become a teacher. Now, it's not necessarily that you have an office, once again, but any time that you open your mouth and words go out, and words are among the most powerful tools or instruments that anyone can possibly use. Through words, people can be built to exceedingly great heights, and through words, they can be absolutely crushed and destroyed. Through words, kingdoms have risen and fallen. I mean, we could go to Proverbs, which we will eventually go to Proverbs and read some scriptures concerning words. But words have tremendous power, as James brings out here himself. So when we look at the scripture, don't think just in terms of desiring to be in an office. Once again, there's nothing wrong with desiring to be in an office if the motive and the methods are correct. But you also need to look at this from the point of view that anytime you open your mouth, you become a teacher if someone is standing alongside. And as it says in 1 Corinthians 14:3, any time that we open our mouth, it should be for the purpose of exhortation, edification, or comfort. That's your basic guidelines: edification, exhortation, and comfort. 1 Corinthians 14:3. Now, in addition to this, with regard to desiring the office of a bishop, it says very clearly in Hebrews chapter 5 that no man takes this honor to himself. You're not supposed to force your way into the office of a teacher and set yourself up as a teacher. And a lot of people do set themselves up as teachers, perhaps unintentionally, but it surely does happen. I know in this particular church area, one of the main ways that people set themselves up as teachers has to do with health. Anytime that someone gets sick, there are people who have various remedies and magic potions that they want to administer to you. They have heard of this whack factor or this doctor or this potion or something like that. Actually, they're not whack factors, they're quack factors. There are some quack factors and there are some quack factors and there are some bona fide chiropractors and people who do use that particular science correctly. But in this area of healing and health, there are all kind of people who have the right potion for you and the right lotion. So beware of other people's potions and lotions and what they might try to sell to you in the terms of words. And there are people who get into whole programs and they pass this information on to others throughout the church. For example, they may read a book on allergies. And one of the great things that's sweeping the whole world today has to do with allergies. Everybody's allergic to something. And there's the yeast diet that, we shouldn't call it the yeast diet. It's the idea that if you eliminate yeast from your diet, then you're going to cure many of your allergies. So you do away with the breads and other foods that contain yeast. You go off yeast, and that will kill your allergies. And there are all kind of things. We could go on and on. I'm just trying to make the point that any time that you get on your soapbox and you begin to tell people this is the way or what about trying this? You need to be careful. And just because that someone is doing it who has an office, for example, does not make it right. You need to be careful. You need to know whether or not it does conform to the Word of God and whether or not it conforms to bona fide, known physical laws that govern the universe. There, in other areas, people become teachers. I guess you could use the term before they know it, in things pertaining to the Scriptures. They may hear some kind of speculation concerning prophecy, and they're anxious to pass it on to other people. So, once again, anytime you open your mouth, you need to be careful as to what your motive really is. In James 3, let's read verse 2. For in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. So it surely is one of the keys to going on to perfection, to be able to control your tongue and use it properly and use it wisely. You must make sure that when you speak, and especially if you're speaking spiritual things, as it says in Isaiah 8:20, that you are teaching according to the law and the testimony. Now, we are all called ultimately to become teachers. And we really need to know what the qualifications are for being a teacher at the present time. Let's prove quickly that we're all called to be teachers back in Isaiah chapter 61, verses 3 and 4. Isaiah 61, verses 3 and 4. And you've probably heard sermons during the Feast of Tabernacles in which ministers would tell you things that you need to develop in order to be a teacher or a king or a priest in the world of moral. I know at St. Petersburg we had an excellent sermon by Mr. Guy Ames on preparing to teach in the world tomorrow, and he used an acronym and a mnemonic device at the same time to give the qualifications for a teacher. He says, I'm going to give you 7 keys to preparing to be a teacher in the world tomorrow, and he proceeded to give the keys. Number 1 was the truth. Number 2, education. And he proceeded then to go all the way through giving the various keys, and when he got through, it spelled the word teacher. The beginning letter of each word spelled the word teacher. So that was a very good way of presenting, a way that you could remember each one of them. So in Isaiah 61 and verse 3, to appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, to give unto them beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness, that they might be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the eternal, that he might be glorified. And they shall build the old wastes, they shall raise up the former desolations, they shall repair the waste cities, the desolations of many generations. So you see the context. Those in Zion who have been mourning, they are going to be ministered to, and God is going to remove the mourning and turn it into joy. And you'll notice that, as we just read, that they're going to build the waste places. But in verse 6, you shall be named the priest of the eternal. Men shall call you the ministers of God. You shall eat the riches of the Gentiles, and in their glory shall you boast yourselves. So you're going to be priests and ministers of God. And one of the main responsibilities, of course, will be to teach. So we've all been called to teach, and we really need to learn how to teach. And also, we really need to learn to be careful what we teach and make sure that it does correspond to the law and the testimony, Isaiah 8:20, once again. In verse 3, let's continue. Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouth that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also the ships, which though they be so great and are driven of fierce wind, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, wheresoever the governor list or wishes. So once again, showing the power of the tongue. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defiles the whole body, sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. Now, when we think about the tongue and we read it, verses like that, generally we think about active use of the tongue, but there are two uses of the tongue when it gets down to actual application. There is the person who actually says whatever it is, and generally, let's diagram it here, the person who passes on gossip, he will purport to report some source. And the way it works, he'll come up and say, I don't know if this is true or not, but I have heard, and the source is a pretty good source. And once again, now, I'm not saying this, but this is what I've heard. I have heard, and then he goes. So you have the source is quoted, and then you have a medium. In other words, someone who actually mouths what he's heard. Then you have a recipient over here. You have a listener. And this listener is just as much involved in it as the person who is saying it, as far as responsibility. And it all goes back once again to the source, you know. This person, he's innocent. He's innocent. He didn't say it. He didn't think it. He's merely reporting what he heard. Well, obviously, this guy is the one who is really doing the devil's work. And that's one of the main things that Satan does. He is an active accuser of the brethren before the throne of God day and night. He is a continual medium. Of course, oftentimes he's the source and the medium. Hold your place there and look at Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. Verse 10, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of His Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, who accuses them before our God day and night. So you have two uses of the tongue. You have the active use, and Satan accuses day and night before the throne of God. You have the passive use. The passive, that's the listener, that's the recipient. And whether you fall in the category of an active gossiper or slanderer, the literal meaning of this word accusation here in Revelation 12:10 is slanderer. He's continually trying to put somebody else in a bad light. Now, he doesn't come on that way. He actually comes on as your friend, as your buddy. Now, I just thought you ought to know this because I bet you are fairly good friends with this person, and I heard that they blah, 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 blah. And so, discord is sown among the brethren, and it's one of the things that God absolutely hates. So, you can be an agent of Satan the devil by active or passive use of the tongue. In the Bible, there are several different places where we're told that we should not be gossipers and we shouldn't pass things along. And we'll go through some of the Proverbs right now to demonstrate that. Let's turn back to Proverbs chapter 15. We'll get some excellent instruction with regard to the use of the tongue. And first of all, we're going to concentrate mainly on the misuse of the tongue, or the active use of the tongue. In Proverbs, didn't I say 15? It's Proverbs 26 and verse 20. In Proverbs 26 and verse 20. In Proverbs 26 and verse 20, where no food wood is, the fire goes out. So where there is no talebearer, the strife ceases. In other words, where there is no medium to pass on the words, then the fire goes out. As coals are to burning coals and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. The words of a talebearer are as wounds. They go down into the innermost parts of the belly. Burning lips and a wicked heart are like a potsherd covered with silver dross. He that hates dissembles with his lips and lays up deceit within him. When he speaks fair, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart. And speaking fair has to do with another use of the tongue and in the active sense. And I'm going to cover this in just a moment, but I'll introduce it right now. Another active use of the tongue is flattery. Some people continually try to pass on bad news, as it were, about somebody else or something. But there are other people who misuse the tongue by being flatterers, but they're using flattery for their own advantage. Let's notice Proverbs 26:19, since we're here right now, and we'll see the other aspect of the recipient or the listener, 26:19. So is the man that deceives his neighbor and says, am I not in sport? A man who deceives his neighbor and says, am I not in sport? So you do not want to deceive your neighbor, and you don't want to listen to the words that the gossiper passes on. In Proverbs, since we're here, let's notice what it says back in Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6, where God lists seven abominations that he hates. He lists six abominations, and in Proverbs 6, verse 19, he says, a false witness that speaks lies, and he that sows discord among the brethren. So God hates those, hates the abomination, those that sow discord among the brethren. Now, there are many other scriptures in Proverbs that talk about the misuse of the tongue. Now, what I have done, the book of Proverbs, which I'm going to ask you to do, there won't be a grade on it, but I'm just asking you to do it, because it'll only be between you and God and whomever with regard. What I did in the book of Proverbs, that I went all the way through, and everywhere that the book of Proverbs refers to the use of the tongue. Now, sometimes they have lip, sometimes tongue, sometimes mouth, and I went through, and everywhere that tongue, lip, or mouth, or gossip, or anything like that was used, I circled that word, and I wrote a word in the margin about it. So if you go all the way through Proverbs with mouth, tongue, lip, words, like that, it will give you a great deal of insight immediately. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride, and arrogancy, and the evil way, and the froward mouth do I hate. With her much fair speech she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips she forced him. And I just go on and on. I either have an X or a circle. In chapter 11 there are several using the mouth. In chapter 12 there are several with the mouth. In chapter 13 several mouth. And so on, it goes all the way through. And I would ask you to do that. That'll give you a great deal of insight immediately into proper use and misuse of the tongue. Now back in Psalm 15, Psalm 15 covers both aspects of the use of the tongue, the active and the passive. Psalm 15. Lord, who shall abide in your tabernacle, in your dwelling place? Well, today the church is the tabernacle of God. It is Zion. And eventually, of course, those who are in the resurrection will dwell in New Jerusalem. Lord, who shall abide in your tabernacle, in your church, in your dwelling place, in New Jerusalem eventually? Who shall dwell in your holy hill? He that walks uprightly, works righteousness, speaks the truth in his heart. He that backbite not with his tongue. So you got the active use of the tongue. He that backbites not with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, or takes up a reproach, as it says in the King James. But if you'll note in the margin, you'll note what it says. Receives a reproach against his neighbor. Passive use. So he doesn't backbite with his tongue, and he doesn't receive a reproach against his neighbor. In whose eyes a vile person is condemned, but he honors those who fears the eternal, he that swears to his own hurt and changes not. He that puts not his money to usury, nor takes reward against the innocent, he that does these things shall never be moved. Verse 3, once again, the key verse, he that backbites not with his tongue, nor takes or does evil to his neighbor, nor receives a reproach or endures a reproach against his neighbor. The person who listens to the gossip is just as guilty as a person who perpetrates the gossip. You'll notice in Isaiah chapter 3, you have something similar. And you've heard of the so-called old Chinese proverb, he who hears no evil, sees no evil, speaks no evil. Well, that's exactly what this says in Isaiah chapter 33. The context is, who will dwell in Zion? Who will dwell in God's church? And who will be in the kingdom of God? Because the context has to do with purifying right at the end of the age. In Isaiah 33 and verse 14, the sinners in Zion are afraid. Of course, that time is going to come when the wheat and the chaff are going to be separated. The time is going to come in which the tares are going to be removed. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Jesus Christ is going to come as a devouring fire. Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? He that walks righteously, speaks uprightly, he that despises the gain of oppressions, that shakes his hands from the holding of bribes, stops his ears from the hearing of blood, and shuts his eyes from the seeing of evil. So he speaks uprightly. He does not speak falsely, see. He speaks no evil. He stops his ears from the hearing of blood and shuts his eyes from the seeing of evil. He shall dwell on high. His place of defense shall be in the munitions of rocks. Bread shall be given him. His waters shall be sure. One of the problems we have, of course, with students in an institutional setting like this where there is so much familiarity and everybody knows everybody else's business and every little move, there's this continual whispering that goes on among some about other people. And if you're in tune at all with what the Scriptures say, that would be stopped immediately, of the continual little whispering about things of other people. I gave a forum last year, and basically I said, if we were to be able to write down all the words that have been uttered among Vassar College students during the past year, what would be the substance of those words? Just consider what you've said in the past few days. What would be the substance of those words? Well, I believe that well over 50% of those words would have to do with your talking about what someone else did. Now, I know some of it would not be in a category of gossip per se, but it would have to do with what somebody else did. That almost consumes our conversation, is what somebody else did. And very often, what they did is not worth the breath that it takes to utter it. I mean, it's not going on to higher things at all. And generally, it's not edifying, exhorting, and comforting. It's just a rehash of what has been done or what has been said. And some way we got a vicarious experience and some kind of satisfaction, which I can't quite understand, by repeating somebody else's exploits or our own exploits or what they did. It would be much better if we could talk about things that are more meaningful and that have greater spiritual value. And one of the things that people are continually doing, especially when they are in close quarters in an institutional setting, if you'll notice in Ephesians chapter 5, something that we're warned against, that we try to give others little coded messages continually in the form of jesting, instead of really facing them as brother to brother and saying whatever it is in a loving way to our brother. Well, we want to have them get the point and to put them in their place, but to do it in the form of a joke. You know, we were just joking. But the recipient of the joke goes away later that day or that moment and says, well, I know you said it's a joke, but is that what you really think about me? Is that what I am? And we are warned in Ephesians chapter 5. Paul is listing here several things that the saints shouldn't do. In verse 3 he says, but fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not be once named among you as become saints. Neither filthiness nor foolish talking. Foolish talking nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks. We always have the practical jokesters who are continually trying to put everybody in their place and to be the sort of comedian on campus. And comedy in America is really sick. Comedy, of course, appeals to much of the comedy. There is good, bona fide humor, and I really love good, pure, clean, spontaneous, creative, natural humor. But the sick kind of humor that so many people indulge in is repulsive. You know what? Humor in America takes on one of two forms, generally. And here's how the comedians get rich. We are attracted to humor when people put themselves down. Now, there is, you know, we're told continually, and surely it's a true saying, that we should not take ourselves too seriously. And we shouldn't. And we should be able to laugh at ourselves. But to put ourselves down deliberately so that others will laugh and in turn say, he's a great guy. You see, if the motivation is to attract attention to ourselves so that people will think of us in a certain way because we have deprecated ourselves, and we have so-called gotten down on their level so they can identify with us. Well, there's a certain amount, I suppose, you could do with that. But you need to be careful how far you go in deprecating yourself. When you read through the Bible, and I know that we get up and we talk about that God has a great sense of humor, and Jesus Christ has a great sense of humor, and I'm sure they do. I know the fruits of the Spirit, the first three, love, joy, and peace. But in reading through the Bible, I've never seen God or Christ deprecate themselves. I just haven't seen it. And on the other hand, I've never seen them deprecate anyone else, though they do deprecate or condemn evil, wickedness. And also, you won't find God and Christ defending themselves. But we're attracted to humor that puts other people down. Now, a lot of the comedians have made a living by putting themselves down. But they generally get into putting others down. Let me give you one of the most notable examples of recent times. Joan Rivers. I'm definitely not a fan of Joan Rivers because Joan Rivers needs, as my grandmother used to say, she needs some Red Devil Lye to wash out her mouth and her throat and to give it a thorough cleansing, because the things that come out of her mouth are not exactly the purest words you've ever heard spoken. But Joan Rivers is continually talking about her body. That she has a flat chest, and she has this, and she has that, and she is just totally unattractive in the sexual sense. And then on the other hand, do you know about my husband? And she begins to talk about her husband, what a boring person he is, and terrible lover, and all that. Well, by the way, recently her husband committed suicide. And then Saturday Night Live, it's continually putting down the establishment, showing how wrong it is. And then there's Bob Hope, Jack Benny, Red Skelton. They continually put themselves down and flattered others. And then on the other hand, you got the Rodney Dangerfield type, who comes on with, I don't get any respect himself, but all the words that come out of his mouth really have to do with putting down other people. So either one of the extremes, where you're continually putting down yourself, or whether you're continually putting down others, if it's not healthy, then don't do it. Don't use it. And you have to examine the motive, because in either way, it can be turned into flattery. It can be turned into flattery. And flattery is a tool that can be used, and it's a powerful tool, but it is also a tool that a lot of people use to manipulate others to get what they want. People generally use flattery to make you feel good, but there's also another aspect that should be added. They do it to make you feel good, but also they do it to make you feel good about them. We all like for people who are continually coming in, boy, how are you doing today, Cliff? This is good to see you. Boy, you look really good. I'm telling you, I like the way that you dress. You're such a man. I'm telling you, I don't know what's going to happen. And just go on and on and pumping you up about anything that you want to name. Now, obviously, to give someone a sincere compliment, we need to. And we need to edify and exhort and comfort. But to do it for the purpose of, and the flatterer, he knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. And when he flatters, he eventually wants you to, in effect, worship him and tell him how good he is. Well, what a wonderful guy he is. Boy, he's just always so friendly, patting you on the back. He makes you feel good to be around. Now, if that's sincere and that's genuine, well, great. But if it is not, then you have one of the most deceitful behaviors to deal with that's possible to talk about, really. Let's go back to Proverbs 26. Proverbs 26. We'll pick it up once again, this time with verse 24. He that hates dissembles with his lips and lays up deceit within him. When he speaks fair, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart, whose hatred is covered by deceit. His wickedness shall be showed before the whole congregation. Eventually, his wickedness is going to be revealed. And actually, if he is flattering you to gain advantage, he hates you. We have had flatterers in the church in recent times who went about flattering everybody from Mr. Armstrong up and down the line to gain advantage. Whoso digs a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolls a stone, it will return upon him. A lying tongue hates those that are afflicted by it, and a flattering mouth works ruin. A flattering mouth works ruin. Now, let's just ask you a question. When you think of flattery and the use of flattery, what example could you think of in the Bible of one of the premier flatterers of all time? Okay, do I? Well, Satan definitely uses flattery to try to gain advantage. He will flatter, he will tell you whatever to make you feel good, to try to get you to follow him. In the human realm, name someone else. Okay, Tommy? I'm looking for a specific purpose.
person.
Really, when the Pharisees came before Christ and saying, good master kind of thing, they were speaking facetiously. They really didn't view him that way at all. I'm talking about a specific purpose here. Okay. Delilah and her work with Samson. Some flattery went on there for sure. Yes, Martin? Well, Haman, you read the story, I don't see a great deal of flattery that he used. Okay, Jim? Well, Daniel interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the interpretation was from God. That God revealed to Daniel Nebuchadnezzar's dream. I wouldn't use that as an example. Okay, we'll take one more. Sean? In that, Job did, what did he flatter? It would be hard to construe that as flattery in an active sense. Simon Magus coming to Peter and saying, I would like to have this power. I'm sure that Simon Magus was a flatterer to some degree. Okay. Well, prophesying according to what you know the people want to do is deceit. But it's not necessarily, you're not necessarily flattering. I'm talking about direct flattery in which you use it as a tool to gain to yourself a following. Balaam hired a false prophet, Balak, to prophesy against Israel. Russell? In that, Saul did what? Also what? Saul didn't do a lot of flattering of David when it really got down to it. We'll take one more, then I'm going to move to Nimrod's mother. Well, you won't find Nimrod's mother, whatever her name was, Semiramis. I'm quite sure that she used flattery, but you don't read of it in the Bible. I'm telling you, this case is in the Bible. I said we're going to go on. Let's notice it in 2 Samuel 15. To me, this guy is the premier flatterer outside of Satan himself. He knew how to get the job done. It's the story of Absalom. I just briefly review the story of Absalom. You remember that Absalom was one of David's sons, and that Absalom had killed one of his brothers one of David's sons, had forced his sister. And as a result of him killing his brother, him being Absalom, he fled for a number of years. Then he came back to Jerusalem eventually. And notice what he did. 2 Samuel 15:1. It came to pass after this that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses, 50 men to run before him. And Absalom rose up early and stood beside the way of the gate. And it was so that when any man that had a controversy came to the king for judgment, then Absalom called unto him and said, of what city are you? And he said, your servant is one of the tribes of Israel. And Absalom said unto him, see, your matters are good and right, but there is no man deputed of the king to hear you. Absalom said, moreover, oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man which has any suit or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice. And it was so that when any man came nigh to him to do him obeisance, he put forth his hand, took him, and kissed him. And on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. They were coming to his father for judgment, but Absalom would cut him off, and he would give them this big spiel of flattery and deceit.
I pray you let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. And the rest of the story is that he led a great rebellion against his father, in which there were only about 300 people left in the whole nation with David. But of course, Absalom met a very disastrous end, and his flattery and deception did not pay off. And once again, I tell you, when people use flattery on you, and you don't respond in the way that they want you to, they will eventually turn on you and try to rend you. Because if you don't become one of their worshipers, then you are not their friend. So be careful when you use good words in a wrong way. I mean, that's a stupid remark to say, be careful when you use good words in a wrong way. Don't use flattery. Okay, Bob?
Isn't that what our political system is based upon?
Well, it's somewhat the Absalom approach. You have open mudslinging that's going on. It's incredible. They showed some excerpts this morning on television of the Republican candidates and their mudslinging. Alexander Haig gets up and he says, beware of dole and dole. After all, it's just watered down pineapple juice. And then he makes some other remarks, and then he says, and don't be bushwhacked. And then Pat Robertson gets up, and he begins to say, and my wife will not try to get me to enter into an arms agreement with the Soviet Union so that I can win the Nobel Peace Prize. And then a little bit later, they interviewed him because the press really jumped on him at about the time that he was saying this. Mrs. Reagan was in surgery, or is it around that time, this past Saturday, Sabbath, in which she was having her left breast removed because she had cancer of the breast. And he started, you should have heard him. The man was lying when he began to try to explain. He said, well, you know, I was talking about my wife. I was joking. And he made it appear as if he wasn't even talking about Mrs. Reagan at all. When you get off onto American politics, I mean, my wife recently said, American politics is a joke. I mean, they have stooped to the very lowest level. It is like kindergarten. I mean, kindergarten kids really have more wisdom and come across with more character than what these people are doing at the present time. So, Bob, I suppose the answer to your question is yes, though I would think that Absalom was a more diplomatic, skillful manipulator and not so openly slinging mud and really trying to build up people who came to David for justice, and over a course of time won their hearts. You know, any time somebody puts out their hand to shake hands with you, and you reach over and you kiss their hands, and you, of course, the Bible doesn't tell you everything that was said, but you know that there came this great spiel of flattery to that person. And we do want to use good words, but we want to make sure that those good words are from the heart and that they are not to try to gain attention to ourselves, but quite the opposite, that we're trying to edify, exhort, and comfort another person, not so someone will come around telling you how great you are, or so people will say what a wonderful person that person is, because of the way that their personality manifests itself to you. Now, we tend to view people according to the way that their personality manifests itself to us. In other words, do I get good vibes or bad vibes? Does this person make me feel good? Or does this person tend to pull me down, or however you want to express it? I recently heard a bit of wisdom, which I think is a tremendous wisdom, a person was talking about, and in this case, he was applying it to ministers in America. He said, ministers in America are so intent on loving to be loved that they have forgotten how to love. You see, if you're so filled with loving to be loved, you're really not going to have the kind of spiritual courage that's necessary to properly shepherd a flock. Because to properly shepherd a flock, you have to apply tough love. And to be a leader, you have to apply tough love. To be a parent, you have to apply tough love. And human nature in and of itself despises tough love. People don't want to be corrected. People don't want for you to tell them what their sins and faults are. And there have even been ministers in the Church of God who fall into the trap. Everybody wants to be thought well of. Everybody likes, you know, for their congregation to go around saying what a wonderful minister Mr. So-and-so is. We all like that. What a wonderful so-and-so Mr. So-and-so or so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so is. We all like that. But yet at the same time, what does God really think about what we're doing? Are we doing what God would have us to do, or are we doing what we want to do so that we will be well thought of? People, you know, the Bible is replete with prophecies that talk about, in Isaiah, the people are saying, speak to us smooth things. We don't want to hear the things of God. Remember when God spoke to Israel from Mount Sinai, and His voice thundered, and they quivered and quaked, and they were shaking, and they said, Moses, you go up into the mountain, let God speak to you, and then you come back and tell us what God said. We don't want to hear God's voice. And people really don't want to hear what the truth of the matter is. But by you telling the truth and it properly administering the truth, you are really loving. And when you are just loving to be loved, you may be hating. But you may not be doing your job at all. But let's look in Proverbs now briefly of proper use of the tongue and the power that we all have there for using the tongue properly. In Proverbs 15, verse 1, soft answer turns away wrath. Do you give the soft answer and turn away wrath, or the contrast and grievous words that stir up anger? The tongue of the wise uses knowledge aright, but the mouth of fools pours out foolishness. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life. You really have within your power in the tongue the power of life and death. I'll hold your place there. Let me show you that. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life. Look in Proverbs chapter 18. There's a statement that is made concerning the power. Proverbs 18, verse 20 and verse 21. Proverbs 18:20. A man's belly shall be satisfied with the fruit of his mouth, and with the increase of his lips shall he be filled. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. And they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. In other words, if you try to use your tongue for wrong motives, then it's going to be death unto you. If you use your tongue for right motives and apply right methods, then it should be life unto you. The power of life and death are in the tongue. In Proverbs 15, verse 4, a wholesome tongue is a tree of life. Proverbs 18:21, life and death are in it. Probably if we could have a political candidate run who was somewhat qualified and could keep his mouth shut, he'd probably win. Because you have all the press and all the other candidates there trying to pick apart everything that you say, and so many of these people are putting their foot in their mouth that is unbelievable. A wholesome tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness therein is a breach in the spirit. So you do have the power of life in your tongue. Now let's notice verse 23 in this same chapter. Proverbs 15:23. A man hath joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. And there are several companion verses here. Let's look at verse 30 that goes with this. The light of the eyes rejoices the heart, and a good report makes the bones fat. So it is great to pass on a good report and to be able to speak a good word at the right time. Notice back in Proverbs 12 and verse 25. Proverbs 12 and verse 25. Heaviness in the heart of man makes it stoop, but a good word makes it glad. You can turn around a person's whole day and his whole outlook on life by just a good word. I remember my first year at Ambassador College. 31 years old, I had come here from a university where I was teaching and coaching, had been very successful, and all of a sudden I was thrust in with 18 and 19 year old people, starting all over again. Here I was married, master's degree, two children, and starting all over, going from a good salary to married student employment salary here on campus, and on I could go. And I remember some of those times, and in addition to that, I was in this struggle and turmoil of mind of whether or not I was doing the right thing and what was this doing to my family, and on it went. And through the course of that year, from time to time, there would be 18 and 19 year old students who would walk up to me and give me a good word. It would just turn around my whole outlook, and my whole being would brighten up. Well, that's the kind of use of the tongue that we all have. Every person in here, you have that power to turn around a person's whole outlook on life. And you think, well, boy, I couldn't say anything to Mr. So-and-so that would help them. Oh, yeah, try it. Try it. I would imagine that you could give them a good word that would really help them. The Bible is true. Heaviness in the heart of a man makes it stoop, but a good word makes it glad. It's amazing what a good word can do to turn around our whole outlook and our whole disposition, our whole spirit. We'd be in a state of depression, and someone comes along and gives us a good word, and it's like it's a new day, and we're ready to go on. Also, Proverbs 3:27. Proverbs 3:27. Withhold not good from them to whom it is due, when it is in the power of your hand to do it. Withhold not good from them to whom it is due, when it is in the power of your hand to do it. And we all have that power. We can do it. We can make a difference in our brothers' lives and in the lives of many, many other people in the course of a day. If we'll all just put that power to work. Now in Proverbs 25 and verse 11. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in pictures of silver. A very poetic way of expressing, once again, the power that is in the spoken word to do good. So obviously, if there's such tremendous power in the spoken word to do evil, conversely, there is tremendous power in the spoken word to do good and to completely turn around a person's disposition and outlook on life. So I would like to challenge all of us to really try to put into practice the proper use of the tongue, that we not be participants in the active and passive use of the tongue in the wrong way, that is, either passing on or receiving some kind of slanderous report against our neighbor, that we put away foolish talking and jesting, as it says in Ephesians 5 and verse 4, that we not use flattery, but on the other hand, that we sincerely from the heart try to put the focus and the emphasis on our brother to edify, exhort, comfort him, to build him up, and not for the purpose of him then in turn thinking what a great person you are. As I think back on what I was relating to you concerning my first year at Ambassador College, and I know through the course of that first year there were a lot of students who spoke many good words to me. I can't really remember specifically who they were outside of two or three people, but I know there were far more than two or three people. They were not trying to put the focus, the emphasis on themselves. They were trying to help me. And so we all can do that if we'll just put it to practice, and then it will lay up for you treasure in heaven. I mean, there are so many benefits from it. So let's go back now to James chapter 3. In James chapter 3, verse 7, "For every kind of beast and of birds and of serpents and of things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed of mankind, but the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison." Well, how do you tame the tongue? What are some of the steps that you can take to tame it? Well, very quickly we could demonstrate what it is from the scripture. In Proverbs 4:23 it says, "Keep your heart with all diligence, your mind, because out of it flow the issues of life." In Proverbs 23:7 it says, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." In Matthew chapter 12 and verse 36 it says, "Out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks." In other words, what you think on, what you meditate on, what you put into your mind and your being will eventually be what comes out. So if you want to have the kind of speech that comforts, edifies, and exhorts, then you think on, you meditate on the right things. You think on, you meditate on the Word of God. For example, there are several scriptures in Psalm 119, but I'll just point out some. In Psalm 119, verses 9 through 11, David says, "How can a young man clean his way?" Or clean up his way. And he says, "By hiding your word in my heart, that I might not sin against you." In verse 97 through verse 105, David says, "I meditate on your law day and night. I love your law. It's a light unto my feet, a lamp unto my path." And so Psalm 119 has many areas where it talks about hiding the Word of God within you. In Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8, it tells you what to think on. So if you want good things to come out of your mouth, if you think on, meditate on the things that are contained in the Bible, then that's what eventually is going to come out. But on the other hand, if you're continually consumed with your own thoughts, the thoughts of others, then out of your mouth are going to come forth these things of trivia that really don't amount to very much. Or on the other hand, even worse, of slanderous talk or flattering lips. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of a good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. So when you put together a very positive program in your heart, in your mind, in your being, of thinking on the right things, then out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth is going to speak. The things that come out are going to be right things. Sorry, Matthew 12, 34. So let's read verse 7 again in James 3. For every kind of beast, of birds, and of serpents, and things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed of mankind. You can tame the tongue. Here is part of the formula for taming the tongue. It's really at the essence. But the tongue can no man tame in and of yourself, but through the Word of God and the Spirit of God, it can be tamed. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceeds blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Does a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? Can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries, either a vine figs? So can no fountain both yield salt water and fresh. So the point being that even in nature, nature is consistent, that it brings forth kind after kind and fruit after fruit and water after water, and it doesn't mix it. And then James contrasts, who is a wise man? If you want to know who a wise man is, one that is capable of teaching, he begins to show you one who, the person who really has some of the qualities to be a teacher. Who is a wise man? Or I could say, who is a teacher? Really one that you could look to be a teacher. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of good conduct his works with meekness and wisdom. So once again, by their fruit shall you know them. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. So you can measure yourself. If you're one that is continually envious of others and wondering why they got the promotion and you didn't, and there's strife in your heart, and God knows your heart, and you cannot cover it up from Him. He says, lie not against the truth. This wisdom descends not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. And here he contrasts devilish wisdom with the wisdom of God. And the Greek word here for devilish is D-A-I-M-O-N, D-A-I-M-O-N-I-O-D-E-S. It means demoniacal. This wisdom is demoniacal or devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. In other words, even murder. That when you slander, when you, and we have gone through exercising judgment, mercy, and faith with your brother, and if you don't exercise judgment, mercy, and faith with your brother, as it says in 1 John 3:14, 15, 16, that is really the same as hating him. So if you have envying and strife in your heart, there is confusion in every evil work, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy, willing to forgive others, of good fruits, without wrangling or partiality, without hypocrisy, and the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of those who make peace. So if you're exercising judgment, mercy, and faith with God and with your brother, then you'll be making peace and you'll be bearing the proper kind of fruit, and you would be one who could be a teacher because you're on the road then to wisdom. All right, we'll take up with chapter 4 on Thursday.